The U.S. Senate is debating health care reform again. The newest bill reduces tax credits for buying health insurance and cuts Medicaid funding for the state. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that nationwide, more than 22 million people will lose health care coverage by 2022. I'm Ann Hillman. Today on Talk of Alaska, we'll discuss how these potential changes could affect you and your ability to get treatment. Stay with us.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Welcome to Talk of Alaska. On today's program, we're looking at the Better Care Reconciliation Act of 2017. It's the Senate's latest attempt to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. My guests on today's program are Alaska's Commissioner of Health and Human Services, Valerie Davidson. She joins us on the phone from Bethel. Thanks for being with us. And
Oyana.
Also on the program is Jen Tolbert, a policy expert with the Kaiser Family Foundation in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
And later in the second half of the program, we'll hear from Aviva Arendine from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. Do you have questions about the health care reform bill, things that you don't quite understand? Let us know by calling 1-800-478-TALK. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. Jen, let's get started with you. In Alaska, what are some of the biggest potential impacts of this bill if it passes?
Yeah, so a lot of the talk around this bill is that it is repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. But actually, some of the bigger impacts have to do and will affect the Medicaid program in Alaska as well as in other states. And so importantly, what the BCRA does is it phases out the enhanced federal funding for the Medicaid expansion by 2024 and would also convert the Medicaid financing from an open-ended financing program, which is what it is today.
Wait, what does that mean?
It means that as the states spend money on Medicaid enrollees, the federal government matches those payments at the state's federal matching rate.
Okay.
So as the state spends more, the federal government will match those payments. But what the BCRA will do is will convert Medicaid financing to a capped funding arrangement called a per capita cap, which means that there will be a cap on federal payments. So states can spend money, but only up to that cap. And there will be caps set for different populations, children, adults, the elderly, and the disabled. And then in addition, there'll be an optional block grant that states can adopt for certain adult individuals, Medicaid enrollees.
So then what happens if someone gets a chronic illness and like they exceed that cap?
Well, it's not a per person cap on the Medicaid side. It is a cap to the state. So in essence, it's establishing a limit on what the federal government will pay to the state to help finance its Medicaid program. So again, it's not on a per-person basis, but one of the concerns is that we know that healthcare costs tend to rise at a faster rate than regular inflation, and so this cap would be limited. There would be a growth rate that is initially set at the medical consumer price index, so tracking a little more closely with healthcare costs, but then eventually it transitions to just the consumer price index, which is a much lower growth rate than healthcare costs. And so the expectation is that down the road, states will have to make some really pretty dramatic decisions about who they cover and what services are covered in order to stay within that federal cap.
So Val, your department handles Medicaid for the state. Who does it currently cover?
So right now, there are a number of different categories for coverage for Medicaid. Half of the folks, there are 187,000 Alaskans who are covered by Medicaid. Half of those folks are children. About 8% are adults who live with disabling conditions. About 5% are seniors. About 18% are covered by expansion. About 20% are parent caretakers. But 187,000 Alaskans are covered by Medicaid. And with half of those Alaskans being children, any change that shifts the federal responsibility to states is very problematic for Alaska. Quite frankly, with a $3 billion budget deficit we currently have in our state, it is very unlikely that we are going to be able to absorb that additional responsibility. Our preliminary analysis indicates that it's going to cost the states $3.1 billion. In federal funds that will be lost if this bill goes through. And so, you know, right now the current bill that's before the Senate, the Better Care Reconciliation Act, in its current form, I'm not sure for whom it's better care for. It's certainly not better care for the 187,000 Alaskans covered by Medicaid.
I'd like to remind callers that we welcome all of your questions and comments. You can call us here in Anchorage at 550-8422 or outside of Anchorage, we're at 1-800-478-8255. We're talking about what the Senate's health care bill would mean for the state. $3.1 billion.
And that's just in the first 7 years of implementation.
Oh, okay. And so, like, what would the state have to do to absorb that, or could they?
So we couldn't. We would basically need to cut our Medicaid spending by $632 million just in the first 7 years to stay under the cap. And alternatively, put another way, since our match is about 50% for regular Medicaid, we would have to increase our own spending by $1.2 billion to maintain our current Medicaid program. I think the biggest concern for us is that it shifts that risk. Right now, it's a shared responsibility between the federal government and states. And what this bill does is it shifts that risk from the federal government to states so that if a state has things that we have higher than anticipated enrollment or that's above the cap, that's a problem for us. These are the kinds of things that generally happen. If we have a faster aging population, generally as we get older, we cost more. We need more care. We need more services. And so the expenses are higher. Guess what? Alaska has one of the fastest growing aging populations in the country. The other thing that happens is states that are experiencing economic downturns, and according to all of the economists in Alaska, we are still in a recession. We have not yet hit bottom. When those kinds of things happen, more people are eligible and more people enroll in Medicaid. And, you know, before, under the current Medicaid program, we share that risk with the federal government. But under this bill, that risk is entirely on the state. So it's very problematic for states.
So, Jen, in your analysis of this, does changing Medicaid affect more than just the people who are on Medicaid?
Well, certainly. Obviously, the biggest impacts are to those people who are currently enrolled in the program who may either have their eligibility cut or may experience reduced services that are covered by the program as states have to deal with these caps. But, you know, the effects will be broader. You know, Medicaid pays for over half of nursing home care across the country. And so if those services are cut, then families are going to start bearing more and more of the responsibility of having to finance care for their older parents and loved ones. And so it's not, you know, there will be ripple effects of these changes that will cascade throughout and infect many people.
Are there provisions of the bill that, I guess, compensate for that? at all, like things that go in and would fill in the gap to pay for nursing home care?
Not on the Medicaid side. Pretty much a cut to the program. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that the Senate bill will cut $772 billion from the Medicaid program over 10 years. And there's not really any additional money being put anywhere else to offset those costs to the Medicaid side. On the private insurance side, there's a fund that's created that will enable states to address some of the cuts that people may experience on related to their private insurance coverage through the marketplace. But again, on the Medicaid side, this really is a shift to states in terms of the risk and financing of the program.
With that cut, is there anything that comes with it that would stabilize costs to Medicaid so that the risk to the state isn't as great?
No. One of the things that this bill, you know, despite the concern that, you know, rising healthcare costs is a major problem and a major driver behind both growth in Medicaid spending as well as, you know, rising premiums on the private insurance side, this bill does nothing to address broader healthcare costs. And so, you know, again, when we think about Medicaid, Medicaid is part of a larger system, and it does not operate on its own. So in many ways, the costs that Medicaid bears are a reflection of the healthcare costs throughout the entire healthcare system. And so you can't isolate Medicaid from that. And then the failure of the bill to address any of these broader cost drivers kind of, again, leave states very much at risk for having to make, you know, really difficult decisions that are likely to affect people directly in terms of their ability to get Medicaid and ability to get coverage. You know, even if they are and remain eligible for Medicaid, they may see services cut because of the decisions that states are going to have to make.
So could cuts to Medicaid have impacts on access to care in rural parts of the state?
Absolutely. So here's a couple of misconceptions about the Better Care Reconciliation Act. So there are some populations that are exempt from the cap, and those are IHS beneficiaries, and those are also children who live with disabling conditions. The problem is, although they would be exempt from the cap, the cuts that are being contemplated in this bill are so significant and are so severe that Alaska will have no choice but to cut our programs and cut eligibility and cut services. We won't have any choice. So they will be impacted like everybody else. And so if anybody has any notion that IHS beneficiaries or children who live with disabling conditions are going to be protected, that is simply not true. We will not be able to absorb this kind of change in our Medicaid program.
And is that, Jen, looking at this on a national level, is that true nationwide that states aren't going to be able to absorb the cuts?
Yes, I think that will be the case across all states. You know, some states will be harder hit than others, and there are many factors that will place different states at risk. I think Alaska is facing particular risk because of the aging population and the rural nature of the population that is served by Medicaid. But states across the country are going to feel these effects. And that's why I think we're hearing a lot from governors, particularly governors who adopted the Medicaid expansion, but, you know, governors, Democrats and Republicans alike, who are really concerned about the far-reaching effects of this bill and the bind that it's going to put states in when it comes to covering what are very vulnerable populations. And I think that's what we need to keep in mind. You know, Medicaid covers the elderly and people with disabilities, and these are very, very vulnerable populations. And it, you know, that partnership, that federal-state partnership, is what has enabled the Medicaid program to work. And with the federal government potentially pulling back, you know, under this bill, pulling back its support to states, you know, it really is going to have some dramatic effects on states across the country.
And you are listening to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about healthcare reform. What could the Senate's bill mean for you and for your family? You can reach us at 550-8422 or 1-800-478-8255. We received an email that says, a couple of years ago on Talk of Alaska, I heard the profit margins for the medical industry in Alaska are somewhere around 20%, whereas the profit margins nationwide are around 7%. Is that true? And if so, I think the discussion should start there. And that's from John and Homer. Is that true? Is that part of this conversation?
This is Val. I don't know that that's universally true. There may be some specialty groups for whom that might be true. If so, that certainly is an outlier. But for example, long-term care facilities, they have a cost-based reimbursement rate, and so they don't have anywhere near that kind of profit margin. It's a cost-based reimbursement. And so for our aging population or people who live with disabling conditions, which are a significant portion of our expenditures in the Medicaid program, that is certainly not true.
All right. And we're going to go to the phones real quick. Jen, I know you have to go soon, but I think that this might be aimed towards you. Paul from Sitka, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One of the things I've noticed is that we have a new underserved population with our current health insurance, and that is those of us who are middle age, middle income, and self-employed. And as I've been told by several people and knowledgeable about health insurance, they look at me and say, you are uninsurable, you can't get health insurance, and that's what I've found. I'm wondering if your guests have any insight as to how that might be impacted by some of the changes that are being proposed currently, and I think everyone should have health insurance, and I'm grateful that a lot of low-income people now have health insurance, but I wish it didn't come at the cost of those of us that are middle-income.
Jen?
Yeah, so this is a problem, definitely, and, you know, one of the failings of the Affordable Care Act is that cost of premiums for people who do not qualify for the tax credits can be unaffordable, and particularly in a state like Alaska. Alaska has the highest premiums both in the marketplace but also for employer-sponsored coverage of any state in the nation, and dramatically higher than many other states. So for people who are not eligible for tax credits or subsidies and are purchasing coverage on their own, that does mean that those premiums can be unaffordable. You know, in terms of what the Senate bill does to address that issue, it's not clear that there will be much of an impact. And in fact, the Senate bill does change the structure of the premium tax credits to basically reduce the cost of insurance for people who are younger and increase the cost for people who are older because of the way it changes the tax credits. But it doesn't do a whole lot right now to address the issue of premiums and overall premium cost. There's a provision that's being currently debated that would allow insurers to sell non-compliant plans, so basically really skinny plans that maybe don't cover a full set of benefits, perhaps don't offer hospitalization coverage or coverage for a broader range of services. And so with those plans, you would see premiums drop, but it comes at the risk of, not having full coverage for services that an individual might need. So I do think that, there's still a lot of work to be done. I will mention one other quick thing. Alaska has actually adopted and implemented a fairly innovative program that was designed to reduce premiums. It's called the Alaska Reinsurance Program. And I think this reinsurance program has served to at least lower the increase in premiums from what was anticipated for 2017 to what was actually put into place. It doesn't, though, address the fact that those costs are still too high for many people to afford. But I think a program like that, a reinsurance program adopted on a slightly broader scale, could potentially serve to lower premiums enough for middle-income people to be able to afford them.
All right. And Jen, thank you very much for joining us. Are there any last things that we should definitely be thinking about as we consider what this bill could mean for Alaskans?
I think there are still changes that are likely to occur with this bill. It's still working its way through the Senate. But I do think that we want to be careful to look at all sides and look at the full impacts of this bill. I think, the focus has been a little bit on the private insurance side and what the changes are there. And as we've discussed here today, some of the bigger impacts really will be felt on the Medicaid side. And so we'll need to pay attention and watch and see what or how this bill changes and whether any of those Medicaid provisions are altered to maybe make some of the cuts a little less severe.
As it's written right now, does it provide big benefits to anybody?
Or it depends on your perspective. If you think that, healthcare needs to be less regulated, that is where this bill is certainly moving in that direction. If you think that government doesn't have as strong a role to play in helping to finance the cost of coverage, whether it be through the Medicaid program or through subsidies to lower the cost of private insurance that people purchase on their own, then I think this bill is moving certainly in that direction. But I think the evidence that we've seen is that if these changes were implemented, it will mean a loss of coverage for millions of people, and it likely won't address the cost of coverage and care, which is at the heart of what most people are dealing with and facing and are most frustrated by.
All right. Well, thank you very, very much for joining us. That was Jen Tolbert, a policy expert with the Kaiser Family Foundation in Washington, D.C.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. And I'd like to go back to the phones. We have Stephen on the line from Anchorage.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I was just listening to Jen. I think she was way too timid in saying who really benefits from this bill. And from my point of view, I think it's the pharmaceutical industry. I think that we Americans pay way more for our pharmaceuticals than any other country on the planet. We're not allowed to go across the border into Canada and get our prescriptions filled and so on and so forth. We haven't put any pressure, to the best of my knowledge, on our senators and congressmen to fight for lower pharmaceutical costs. We haven't put any pressure on them to lower the cost of doing war, to divert mm-hmm. more money to health care. And I think a lot of this falls right at Lisa Murkowski, Don Young, and Dan Sullivan's feet, because they are not taking a strong stance against these hugely escalating pharmaceutical costs. And the medications is a big reason why these health care costs are spiraling out of control. There is no check and balance on the pricing from these pharmaceutical companies.
And that's the message you'd like to get across to our representatives in Congress.
Well, I think it's a start.
Mm-hmm.
I think they need to weigh in and fight for us by taking a public stance against these unregulated, spiraling up costs of medication. It just seems like the cost of the healthcare drugs just goes up and up and up. I mean, does anybody agree?
I don't know. Val, would you like to weigh in on this?
Sure. Brianna, for the question. So we certainly have seen an increase in the cost of, in the price of pharmaceuticals over time, certainly over the last 5 years. And, you know, it's not the first time we have heard that concern about the rising cost of pharmaceuticals being unaffordable for Alaskans. And I would really encourage folks to reach out to our congressional delegation and see if something can be done to address the high cost of pharmaceuticals. But I think that you're right that in the Better Care Reconciliation Act, which is before Congress, there really isn't. There really aren't pharmaceutical provisions, so to speak, of in this bill.
Well, thank you, Stephen, for joining us.
Hey, I had one other part to this, and that is there is a little bit, but there's not very much financial allocation for teaching Alaskans how to eat better, to create a preventative program for getting sick, because very often we end up treating symptoms and we really never address the core. The patient doesn't understand why they got sick, and very oftentimes it is from poor eating. And I know that everybody gets to eat what they want to eat, but still, mm-hmm. there's a lot of people out there that would like to be educated in how to eat better to stay healthy.
So more need for wellness and prevention.
Absolutely.
So, on that point, Section 201 of the bill that's currently before the Senate addresses the Prevention and Public Health Fund that was included in the Affordable Care Act. And this version before Congress in the Senate bill actually repeals those appropriations. So we would have fewer prevention and fewer public health funds in the bill currently before Congress.
All right. Good to know. I would like to invite Jill from Metlakatla to the program. Jill, thanks for calling.
Hello. So what I was noticing was that 187,000 Alaskans are on Medicaid, but the Native population in Alaska is about 25%. And if the Native population were backed out of Medicaid, that would leave Medicaid for the poor, non-Native, and disabled people, because healthcare is guaranteed by treaty from the federal government for Native people. And I noticed, I have a son who's disabled, and when Medicaid was expanded, he immediately got whipped onto Medicaid from Indian Health Services, and the quality of his care diminished. And there was these constant pleas from dentists and these other or oral surgeons, stuff like that, to go to Anchorage and have dental work done that was never satisfactory. And I just think that there was a lot of waste, a lot of fraud, and if you backed out the 25% Native population and put that burden squarely on the federal government and leave Medicaid to the poor and the disabled non-Natives, that would save a lot of money.
Val, would you like to respond to that?
Sure. So Medicaid is generally a means-tested program, which means you have to qualify, and you typically qualify for income. There are some exceptions. For example, people who live with disabling conditions qualify.
And for other reasons as well, but mostly folks qualify because of income. And so it is illegal for us to deny coverage to a population for Medicaid based upon race. And so we couldn't deny coverage for Alaska Natives or American Indians any more than we could deny coverage for a person who is not Native. I will say, just from having spent 15 years working in the tribal health system, that there is a misnomer that the tribal health facilities in Alaska are 100% funded by the federal government. The truth is, they are only funded at about 50% of the level of need of funding needed to be able to provide the most basic of health care services. And Congress not only allows but mandates, requires tribally operated health facilities in Alaska and throughout the country, IHS facilities, to seek third-party reimbursement, including private insurance, Medicaid, and Medicare. And so under this bill before Congress right now, it would be a cruel irony if the very provision that required IHS, that required tribally operated facilities to seek and make up that shortfall in funding through Medicaid, to be able to take that away from them and say, no, I'm sorry, that's not going to be available for you anymore.
Well, can people opt out of Medicaid? Can Native people opt out of Medicaid if they want to? Because there doesn't seem to be a lot of choice right now. They're just put in it.
So I'm not sure how it works in Metlakatla, but people can, you as an individual, choose to enroll in Medicaid.
So you don't have to do it, and your Indian Health Services is still in effect.
Well, so the way that the law works under federal law, again, this is federal law, is the IHS service is considered a payer of last resort. And so if there is any other payer available, they must pay first. So if you're a person who is covered by private insurance, the private insurance has to pay first. If you're on Medicare, Medicare covers first. If you are covered by Medicaid, that also covers first. So IHS services are considered the payer of last resort.
Thank you very much for calling, Jill, and thank you for your very useful questions. We're going to take a quick break from Talk of Alaska, and then we'll come back and speak with more callers about the Senate's version of healthcare reform.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in all the training programs from office administration to water and wastewater treatment. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about healthcare reform and what it could mean for the state if the Senate's Better Care Reconciliation Act passes. And I'd like to go again to the phones, but if you have questions, you can call us from Anchorage, 550-8422. Outside of Anchorage, it's 1-800-478-8255. You can email us talk@alaskapublic.org. We have Mary on the line from Fairbanks. Mary, thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and Commissioner Davidson, it's a privilege to talk to you today. I'm specifically interested in infectious diseases in Alaska, and my concern is that the changes to the Medicaid bill may have a trickle-down effect on people who are not Medicaid eligible. So, for example, I know that some Alaska public health services have been cut over the course of the past year or so. And my fear is that if there is no Medicaid reimbursement, or there's less Medicaid reimbursement, then the state will be forced to cut even more services, and then the people who maybe don't qualify for health insurance or can't afford health insurance can't rely on Alaska public health services for, say, things like TB testing, STI testing, et cetera. And I'll take my call off the air.
Thanks very much, Mary.
Brianna, Mary, and it's really nice to meet you too, and you're absolutely right. So our Division of Public Health, and specifically public health nursing, have taken significant cuts since 2015 through the budget process, simply because we have had, first a $4 billion budget deficit, and now we're down to $3 billion. So if folks have a notion that everything's going to be okay if Medicaid gets cut because they can still get their care from a public health nursing center, I'm afraid that those services have been cut as well too. And really, I think it's important for folks to understand that this impacts more than just Medicaid. So if we know that in Alaska we're going to lose $3.1 billion in federal funding in Alaska just in the first 7 years, And that cost is those federal resources are no longer going to be available to really be some of the backbone for Alaska's healthcare delivery system. What's going to happen to that healthcare delivery system? So if you're a person who has private insurance, but you see a provider that has, 30 or 50% of their revenues are no longer available because of the cuts to Medicaid, that is going to impact you as an individual. The other piece is that, there's often a misperception about people who are about Medicaid enrollees. And folks should know that 80% of Medicaid enrollees in Alaska actually live in working households. These are folks who have really low-paying jobs, who are hardworking Alaskans who simply cannot afford to be able to purchase private insurance. And Mary is absolutely right that if those, $3.1 billion in federal resources, which are currently coming to the state to be able to shore up our healthcare delivery system, are no longer there, we are going to be in a world of hurt. And it's going to impact everybody, not just folks who are covered by Medicaid.
And Val, you mentioned that there are programs that wouldn't be available without the Medicaid funding. Can you list a couple of those, please?
Sure. So under this current bill, it would do away with Medicaid expansion. So the almost 35,000 Alaskans who are covered by Medicaid under expansion would no longer be covered starting in 2020. And just to provide a better sense of what that economic impact has been to our state, since September 1st of 2015, when Alaska expanded Medicaid under Governor Walker's leadership, over $515.7 million in Medicaid claims have been paid through June, since September 1st of 2015 through the end of June. $500 million have been paid out in Medicaid claims, and about $40 million of those claims are for behavioral health services, for treatment services, whether it's substance use treatment, including alcohol abuse or opioid abuse, etc. All of those services have been paid for under Medicaid expansion, and before, these are folks who still needed services, but they weren't able to get those services simply because there was no payer to be able to do that. So our incredible bipartisan effort that we worked with the legislature in the last legislative cycle about a year ago passed Senate Bill 74, which was a major Medicaid reform bill in our state. Those opportunities for savings are going to be severely limited because providers will no longer have those Medicaid expansion dollars to be able to cushion the impact and to be able to take that risk. The other thing is, in that same legislative cycle, the legislature passed Senate Bill 91, a criminal justice reform bill, where we as a state made a decision. We can either build more prisons or we can build healthier Alaskans. And we chose to build healthier Alaskans by ensuring that we could reduce recidivism. And one of the best ways to be able to do that is to ensure that we have treatment programs available to folks who are in lieu of incarceration or upon leaving incarceration, that they have access to health care. Has been one of the biggest, nationally, has been one of the biggest impacts on reducing recidivism. And both of those are severely in jeopardy without those Medicaid expansion dollars that have significantly helped our state.
All right. Thanks, Belle. I would like to invite another guest to the program. We have Aviva Arendine, who is another policy expert. This time, she is with the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. Welcome to the program, Aviva.
Thank you.
I'd like to take our next caller. We have Mike on the line from Anchorage.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, good. Welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm an ex-healthcare agent in the state of California, and on Kaiser Health News, which is a great source, Paul Markovich, of the CEO of Blue Shield of California, the largest individual employers, insurance companies in the country, said he doesn't understand really why they're trying to reverse the Affordable Health Care Act. He thinks they should improve upon the strength of it in a bipartisan effort, and I agree. So for the Republicans to repeal the Affordable Health Care Act is ridiculous. It was their idea to begin with. It was conceived under a conservative think tank called the Heritage Foundation, and as a matter of fact, is what Mitt Romney passed in Massachusetts.
Okay.
It's absurd. I mean, it's the best thing ever happened to health insurance. If I had the Affordable Health Care Act when I was selling insurance in California, I had 40 to 70% more customers. But we really need Medicare, Medicaid for all. So everybody get online and get to their congressman and make a comment. Don't repeal it. Don't repeal it. It's ridiculous.
And Mike, your comment is kind of in line with a question that we've gotten through email. Heather would like folks to comment on how Alaskans' health and finances might be affected by potential universal health care, as is provided in New Zealand, Denmark, and other countries where people live longer and healthier. Aviva, I realize it's a little off topic, but is universal health care, is that an option?
I think that is a pretty big leap from the conversation we're having today, which is really about whether we're going to go backwards from the progress we made in the direction of universal coverage in this country. And so just to maybe focus for a moment on the comment from the previous caller, under the Affordable Care Act, our uninsured rate has fallen to its lowest level in history. Alaska has also seen major gains in coverage from both the private market reforms in the ACA and Medicaid expansion, which I know you've already talked about a significant amount on the program. And so I think whether your ultimate vision for this country is a market-based system where people have access to care and we use the tools provided by regulation and financial assistance in the Medicaid program to make sure that people get the care they need at an affordable cost, or your ultimate vision is, as the commenter or the last questioner asked, some sort of universal single-payer system, the most important thing is not to move backwards, withdraw $1.2 trillion from coverage programs, as this bill would do, and cause 22 million people who have their health insurance under current law to lose it.
And so, let's jump to another caller. We have Robin on the line from Fairbanks. Robin, please.
Yes, hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that, you know, for those people who don't want the mandate, there just is no way to provide adequate insurance. Because what happens is those people, they don't want the mandate, they don't buy insurance, and then when they get sick, the rest of us pay for them, which drives up the rest of our premiums. So I think that's the ultimate reason we should have a single-payer system. But I also wanted to say that my husband and I are the victims of the high-risk pool fiasco. I got sick when I was about 50. Those are the middle ages where they're going to raise the premiums. I had to pay almost $800 a month. I had a $14,000 prescription fee per year. So, you know, our deductible went immediately. We had a $15,000 deductible. And basically, over the years of being sick, we lost all of our savings for retirement. And so, as far as I can tell, they're just creating another high-risk pool for those older folks, but just doing it by another name. And it doesn't work. You know, it just ruins people. And I don't want to see younger people coming up have to put up with all of the heartache and you know, just the terrible consequences of not being able to get adequate health care for a reasonable, affordable amount of money.
Robin, thank you for sharing your story. Aviva, what would this act do for people like Robin and do for the high-risk pool?
Well, Robin is correct that many of the people hit hardest under this bill would be older people who are in the position of needing to buy coverage on their own, whether because they retired early or they own their own business or self-employed, for some reason don't get coverage through their employer. This bill would result in very, very large increases in their costs. Some people, some moderate income older people with incomes around $55,000 in Alaska would lose financial assistance altogether under this bill. And so they could see their premiums increase by truly eye-popping amounts, losing $20,000 or more of financial assistance. And at lower income levels, you know, people with incomes of $30,000, $40,000 would have to pay thousands of dollars more to maintain the coverage they have today. The bill also replicates another problem with high-risk pools, which is it potentially hollows out the benefits available through coverage. It would let states waive the Affordable Care Act's requirements that individual market health plans actually cover the kinds of services that people with serious health care needs require, would let them bring back annual and lifetime limits, including for people with employer coverage. And so all of that would hit people in their 50s and 60s very hard. And then on top of that, you have the impacts on Medicaid, which would hit the so-called sandwich generation twofold, affecting care for their parents now, particularly things like home and community-based services that pay for health aides, that pay for helping people stay in their homes and not have to be in nursing homes. And then those Medicaid cuts would really intensify as the baby boom generation moved into retirement themselves and needed some of those services which are paid for by Medicaid.
And then, Anne, this is Val. Mm-hmm. If I may add one more thing.
Please.
Is that, you know, people sometimes don't understand that there is a significant correlation between people who have insurance coverage and Medicaid. And any change that limits either the affordability or the coverage or limits essential health benefits or any kind of change that limits the availability of private health insurance, people eventually will come over to Medicaid. And that becomes a state responsibility. And so, you know, we are all, you know, we're very fortunate, you know, some of us are in relatively good health, but we are all one terrible accident away from a devastating injury or a devastating illness that if we don't have health coverage for, either through insurance or some other method, we will eventually qualify for Medicaid. And so anytime I get nervous every time I see a bill before Congress that limits the availability of private health insurance, because I know that those folks will eventually come over to Medicaid. And I'm especially concerned now because of the bill before Congress, which shifts that federal responsibility and that federal risk over to states. And I think one of the challenges we have about this bill that I'm certainly concerned about is that you know, the changes that they're making to Medicaid, the most of the changes really are not about the Affordable Care Act. They go way beyond that. They go to the heart of the Medicaid program, which had been in existence since 1965. And so really, for the most of the Medicaid provisions in this bill, it is not an Affordable Care Act rollback. It is Medicaid reform.
And when we're talking about making changes to Medicaid that are so basic and that are so fundamental to the existing program, those really should be handled through the regular bill process, through public hearings, opportunity for testimony, for people to be able to weigh in. And doing it through a budget reconciliation process is not a responsible way to do meaningful Medicaid reform. And because states are so impacted, states really need to be able to be at the table to be engaged in those conversations. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the budget reconciliation process does not allow for that. There are absolutely no public hearings. There's no public testimony. It is all being handled on the floor and by leadership in the Senate. And while they will offer amendments, those won't be available to the public for folks to be able to vet. States won't be able to have the opportunity to weigh in. And I think that's just not a responsible way to do it. And so what we have done at the state is to make sure that our congressional delegation is aware of the implications of the decisions that they are being asked to make, mm-hmm. and weigh in so that they know what the impacts to Alaska would be.
We are going to take a very quick break before going to Kristen in Anchor Point.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
And you're listening to Talk of Alaska. Kristen in Anchor Point, thank you for joining the program.
Well, thank you for having me on. To me, this is very important. I'm 64 years old, and I'm on the extended Medicaid program right now because I'm retired. But to me, this is more than just health care versus health insurance. I'm never quite sure why the two got confused. 8 years ago, we wanted universal health care. The majority of people wanted it then. Now, even more people, over 66% of the population want universal health care. And this isn't just a First Amendment, civil right or a human right. What we're talking here is a very important national security issue. How can a country survive if massive amounts of its people are dying, injured and cannot work, are so sick they cannot work, cannot function within the government, cannot function within their jobs. This is much more important than a new aircraft carrier or a submarine. This is much more important than any type of first-strike missile capability. This goes right to the heart of why our republic exists. It exists for the people of the United States. It doesn't exist for the very rich. It exists for us. And they are endangering our lives and our security and our right to function by literally saying, you don't matter. You don't need health insurance. You don't need health care. If you can't afford it, fine. There's a rock over there. Crawl underneath it and die. As far as I'm concerned, this is a national security crisis we're having, mm-hmm. not just a health insurance crisis, but national security. This is how it needs to be approached. Because if we don't approach it this way, those people in Congress, the President of the United States, will never listen to us.
And Aviva, you're based out of D.C. and have been analyzing this bill. Are people looking at it in the larger context beyond just what it means for health care and health insurance?
I think it has been striking how motivated people have been to make their voices heard for exactly the reasons that you described. And I really wanted to sort of hone in on a comment you made about health insurance versus health care and how we sometimes separate the two and sometimes talk about the debate over the bill in these sort of sterile terms as if it was just about, you know, do people have health insurance, yes or no, and lose what that means in terms of access to health care for them and their families. And it's striking, too, that this is all playing out as we are starting to get the first sort of real research and data about what the Medicaid expansion and other coverage reforms under the Affordable Care Act have meant for health care and for health, one particularly careful study of Medicaid expansion in several states found that it led to big increases in people going to the doctor, getting various kinds of preventive care, saying that they feel they are in good health and getting the health care they need, and reductions in the share of people screening positive for depression. And other evidence is coming in, you know, whether it's from national surveys where people say, no, I'm no longer skipping medications due to cost, or from other research designs that show how Medicaid expansion has improved access to mental health care, to substance use treatment. And so I think it would be really tragic at this moment where we're seeing such clear proof of that nexus, that health insurance does in fact translate into better access to care and better health, to then go backwards on that access to coverage. I think would be a tragedy for people's health care and for the larger issues that the caller described.
Thank you.
So this is Val, and I just wanted to say I'm so glad you were able to get enrolled and get coverage through Medicaid expansion. And, you know, one of the things that Governor Walker has said repeatedly is that, you know what, people can't work. They can't hunt. They can't fish. They can't provide for their families if they are not healthy enough to do so. And so access to coverage and access to health care, to be able to get your prevention screenings, to be able to get your basic health care needs met, is really, really a critical point in not only maintaining your self-sufficiency for you and your family, but also gaining self-sufficiency. We have heard from so many Alaskans who had not been able to work because they didn't have access to basic health care, and once they got a Medicaid expansion, they are now back to work. They're working again. Back to your point about the military, this was some years ago, and I'm not sure how true it is today, but I suspect things have not changed that much. But I know that there was a point in time where with the active military population, the number one reason why folks were not able to go and be ready for military duty was because of their teeth. They didn't have access to basic oral health care services, and their teeth were so bad that they couldn't serve in active military duty.
Wow. I want to jump on a couple things that have just come up in this past conversation. The first is preventative care. Under this bill, will people who have employer insurance or other types of insurance, will everyone still be insured to get preventative care? Aviva?
The bill does not change the ACA's requirement that employers cover preventive care, but it does change a number of the other ACA provisions that apply to employer coverage. In particular, it allows states to take these waivers of essential health benefits standards, which would feed through to people's employer plans by allowing them to go back to imposing annual or lifetime limits on coverage and go back to not having caps on people's out-of-pocket costs. So that really goes to the whole sort of point of insurance. Before the Affordable Care Act put in place these requirements, even people who had insurance through their jobs and presumably believed they were covered could actually find themselves exposed to catastrophic costs if they really got sick. And that could come back under this bill.
All right. That is all we have time for. Thank you very much. We've been talking about healthcare reform. My guests today were Valerie Davidson, the Alaska's Commissioner of Health and Human Services, Aviva Arendine from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, and earlier we had Jen Tolbert with the Kaiser Family Foundation in Washington, D.C. Thanks all very much for joining us.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.